Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of October 4th. This week we were joined by America columnist Kyle Kramer, who has an article in the current issue called Appalachia's Wounds about mountaintop removal in eastern Kentucky. Kyle, in addition to being a columnist for America, operates the Genesis Organic Farm in southern Indiana. He is also the director of graduate lay degree programs and spiritual formation for St. Meinrad, a Benedictine monastery and school of theology. I spoke to Kyle by phone.
Well, Kyle, perhaps you could begin by describing the process of mountaintop removal for people who may not be familiar with it.
Sure, Tim. Well, there are basically three kinds of coal mining. Shaft mining, obviously, where you dig a tunnel, you haul coal out, and then at the end you've got relatively little above-ground disturbance. Then you have strip or open pit mining, in which you take off the timber, you blow and bulldoze off the soil and the underlying rock and take the coal, and then you really do have to reclaim that to its original contour. That's a form of mining that's prevalent in my area, so I'm more familiar with it. But mountaintop removal mining is basically strip mining on steroids. As with strip mining, you take off the timber and the topsoil, and then you use explosives to loosen what's called the overburden, an interesting and ironic name for a mountain. And once that's gone, you expose a coal seam that's usually several hundred feet below the original surface of the mountain. And when you're removing that much rubble, you can't put it back in its original place. You have to shove it into the original valleys. At least that's the most economical way to do it. And an active mining site, Tim, it looks like a moonscape. It looks like Armageddon. And even after reclamation, I was able on this tour to see a few quote-unquote reclaimed sites, and I think I'll always put that in quotes, because the reclamation is that pretty much in name only. What's left is a headless mountain, or like a butte of sorts. And what's left also is a disaster for the residents who remain in terms of destruction of the water table and, of course, the wildlife diversity. Grass struggles to grow there, and invasive species are showing up or even being planted. And so what remains is nothing like what was there before.
Now, I'm sure, you know, prior to this trip that you took, which I should say was part of a sponsored trip with other religious organizations, correct?
That's right. The Center for Interfaith Relations out of Louisville, Kentucky, sponsored the trip.
And you went down to the West Virginia Appalachian area to witness some of this firsthand.
Yes, Eastern Kentucky.
Eastern Kentucky. Obviously, you had heard about some of the environmental problems with MTR, as it's known, but what was it about seeing it in person that really kind of drove home the real problems with this?
Well, I went as a conservationist and as someone who had a stake and a vested interest in these kinds of issues beforehand, but to some extent beforehand they had been issues for me, somewhat more abstract. And while I think in physics, philosophy, even theology, human beings have a very impressive capacity for abstract thought, I really think what moves us at our core is things that are concrete, personal experience. And so in that regard, I think it was really valuable to see this devastation firsthand. I kid you not, Tim, we would go and see half a mountain gone and just a sheer face of what remained if mining were in process. We saw streams running orange with iron bacteria, and so we saw a landscape that was just irrevocably destroyed, if you ask me. But more important was the chance to meet the people whom MTR affects and to hear their stories. I mentioned in my article Rick Hanshew, a longtime resident. His family is in that area since the 1700s. He's an activist for Kentuckians for the Commonwealth. And to hear how he and his organization struggles against this behemoth of the mining industry. We heard stories from ex-miners, one in particular, the son and the grandson of miners who bucked family pressure and community pressure, and he's now documenting mining violations. He's walking around with a GPS and a camera. We heard stories from residents who were not necessarily activists, but were just there to witness to their own suffering and the suffering of their communities, their houses cracking apart, filled with dust from these constant explosions and earth moving. Even my own experience, we stayed overnight in Jenny Wiley State Park, and the park itself is quite beautiful. It's nestled among these hills and hollers, and I was out on a hike, felt very much isolated and wonderfully so in terms of the wildness there. And yet, throughout that hike, I heard this dull thud from every direction, which were these explosions going off in these active mines. So it was bracing at the very least, horrifying, I think one could say, to see this devastation, to hear from people who feared for their lives to speak out, people whose businesses were destroyed or boycotted from mine companies, and to see how communities themselves were really torn apart because of this kind of activity in them.
Well, the way you describe the devastation there, in your article, it comes across as almost biblical in nature in terms of the kind of injustice that's being done here.
Absolutely. In fact, the scripture that I've thought about in connection with this is, I believe, from Matthew 13, where Jesus says something along the lines of, to those who have little, even that will be taken away, and to those who have more, they'll be given more. And obviously, I'm proof texting a bit, but it seems completely apropos, but utterly tragic, that those who are profiting here are the ones who desire profit most and have the most power, and those who have nothing have even that taken away.
Now, I would assume that a number, you said you talked with a number of local families, that some of them at least work in this industry, that this is a livelihood for them. Does that complicate their relationship and their views on this issue?
Absolutely. And I would say the attitudes are really mixed. There are those who support mining, of course, because they see it as the only really viable economic base. And mining, Tim, it's part of the culture in Appalachia. And even though it's destroying people's homes, a lot of people support it. Some support it with enthusiasm and kind of a resistance against any outsiders messing with their economy. Others report it really out of resignation for lack of other options. We heard plenty of stories in which people would say that coal put food on their table, put a roof over their heads, it would send their kids to school. So I also, in terms of part of the culture, the religious culture, I think in that area there are a lot of folks who hold a religious worldview that really has heaven as the goal, and so what matters to the earth isn't quite as important. In fact, may even help hasten the coming of the kingdom. So you have those folks who support it. Then on the other hand, you have the activists who see this devastation, who are trying to stop it through demonstrations, through public hearings, working for legal change. And what's interesting, Tim, is that these supporters and detractors are often in the same families. They're certainly in the same communities. They're often in the same parishes and congregations. And so it makes it really difficult for a religious leader, for a pastor who wants to speak out about MTR, but also wants to pastor the entire flock. I had a conversation with Father John Roush. He's a Glen Mary priest, active in the area for quite a while. And he's had people get up, parishioners get up and leave a service when he addresses MTR in his homilies. What's insidious about this, though, I think precisely because of these different attitudes toward mining, in many cases the mining companies will get them to spend their energy fighting each other while the mining companies themselves go on their merry way and in some ways get off scot-free.
It's interesting you mentioned, you know, the different religious views on this issue, and in particular in your article you quote that there's some proof texting going on the other side as well, where people look to the Bible and say, well, actually, you can almost justify this behavior by looking at certain texts.
Yes, that's true, and I have to say I think that's the most egregious use of Scripture I've ever seen. It's certainly not a Catholic approach to Scripture, getting at some of the deeper truths. It's picking one conveniently phrased snippet and using it like a weapon, which I think is always problematic when you start dealing with a community's holy texts.
Perhaps you could just read that section of scripture for us.
Yes, they pull from, ironically, the prophet Isaiah, who has many things to say about exploitation of the poor, even in nearby verses to this one. But in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 4, every valley shall be filled in, every mountain and hill shall be made low, the rugged land shall be made a plain, the rough country a broad valley.
Now, do you see, are there, this group that you went with was, as you said, a group of people from different religious faiths. Is there a special way that people of religious belief are called to work against this, work against MTR?
I think so, Tim. In fact, I think it must be so. On one level, religion, and I'll speak broadly, both of the Catholic tradition and others that were represented there, religion is a bearer of ethics. And to speak from a Catholic context, MTR violates pretty much every principle of Catholic social teaching. The life and dignity of the human person, an emphasis on community and family, basic human rights, an option for the poor and the vulnerable, the dignity of work and workers' rights, solidarity, and of course, care for God's creation. Every single one of those is violated by this. And I think a religious tradition, it's incumbent on a religious tradition to stand up for the ethical principles that MTR violates. Going beyond that, or in addition to that, hand in hand with it, to my mind, the core of any authentic religious tradition is compassion. Outward religious observance, we read in our own scriptures, it's meaningless if it doesn't cultivate compassion for those who suffer. And in this case, the Appalachian people who have very little voice, and for the Appalachian landscape itself, which has no voice at all except when we speak for it. And I would say, drilling down even more deeply than ethics and compassion, is religious imagination. If you read the Psalms, if you read the prophetic literature, if you read Gerard Manley Hopkins or any good poet, landscape is the source of all religious imagination. It's the source of all metaphors and analogies of God. Those are rooted in the natural world. Of course, I say that as an organic farmer, so consider the source, but I think others would back me up on that. So in some sense, we have to preserve creation and these communities for their own sake. But I'd also say for our own sake as well, because I think a religion bereft of the images and the poetic imagination that's rooted in landscapes like these, that's a religion that's on its deathbed.
As you mentioned, you're an organic farmer, so you already live a life that's kind of close to the ground, to nature. Has this trip changed even the way you conduct your life and the way you consume energy?
Well, I went in, as I said, with a lot of opinions about this in the beginning, and we have made a lot of steps on our own place. We have a solar and wind power array on our farm. But interestingly enough, Tim, when I first moved to this land, I wasn't married, didn't have kids, and was living very primitively, off the grid, as it happened, with solar panels and a few golf cart batteries. And as things happen, when I got married and we had children and expanded our farming operations, we needed more power. And so we linked up to the grid, kept some of our solar equipment, kept it all rather, and have slowly been adding to it. But I still would say our power usage outstrips the power that we generate. So it's changed us in regard to, for example, we went through this summer, this very, very hot, muggy summer, forgoing our air conditioning, but for a few quote-unquote emergency occasions, and likewise kind of being stingy with our power use even more so than we had. I'd also say, when I got back from that trip, I was shocked and angry, and it so happened that there was an annual meeting of our rural electric cooperative. So I went to this meeting, and I was really stunned to learn how these kind of issues weren't at all on the table. and that the meeting itself was almost an infomercial for the virtues of coal. And so at the end of the meeting, not having been able to get a word in edgewise beforehand, I asked some of the folks running it if they had any experience with mountaintop removal mining. And to a person, they'd never been to a site. I've been trying locally to get our own cooperative to purchase green power and make it available with no success thus far. That's my continuing guilt. So what we are trying to do as a family is, I guess I'd call it eco-tithing, where whenever we have a little extra money, which is rare these days, we are continually investing in our power system so that we are expanding it, and with the goal of becoming net zero, which means we use as much as we make, or even a producer where we actually give a bit of power back to the grid.
For the average, perhaps Christian, average parish, maybe in a suburban or city environment, are there ways that they can try to reduce their energy consumption that might have a real effect?
Absolutely, and I would say more so of an effect even than moving out to an organic farm and bolting solar panels onto your roof, although I think that's part of the mix. I would say first and foremost, we need to pray. If you go to a mountaintop removal site, you'll know what we're up against in terms of stopping something this egregious and this huge. I mentioned David and Goliath in the article, but I think it's more like David versus 100,000 Goliaths. And so prayer is first and foremost, must be our response. I think beyond that, practically speaking, individuals in cities, communities, religious communities, need to stop feeding the beast, need to investigate ways to purchase power more responsibly, and to look into installing, even if just as for its witness value, installing alternative energy, solar panels, windmills, etc., on their buildings. I believe congregations need to be educated. Interfaith Power and Light is a resource. The Catholic Committee of Appalachia, the Center for Interfaith Relations, ILoveMountains.org, doing energy audits for parish buildings and for individual homes. The less energy we need to use, the less energy we need to get from coal. So I think that would be a big step. One step beyond that is education and advocacy. Mountaintop removal mining, Tim, could stop with the stroke of a pen if the legislative climate was amenable to that. And there are some indications that the tide may be shifting in that regard. But that's going to take, at the local level, it's going to take letters to the editor, conversations with local power companies about their policies for sourcing their coal, and ultimately it's going to take national legislation that ceases to grant permits for mountaintop removal mining. That's what needs to happen. But then if we're successful in that regard to stop this mining, that's only half of the equation for Appalachia. It would be very easy for an environmental activist in New York City to do all of this advocacy work, finally get mountaintop removal mining stopped, and then wash their hands of it. But in some sense, that leaves the people of Appalachia high and dry. It's a great victory, but short of any kind of substitute sustainable economy in that region, there's just going to be some new exploitation coming down the road. And so I'd say the average individual, certainly faith communities in urban and rural areas together, they can visit Appalachia, they can do mission work, they can take the kind of witness tours that I was on, and not only learn about the issues, but bring expertise in to try to empower folks in Appalachia to create a sustainable economy that's going to last and that doesn't depend on stealing their own resources. But so stop feeding the beast in terms of their own power use, become an educated activist to change legislation, and work with empowered Appalachian residents to help a new kind of sustainable economy emerge in that region.
Well, Kyle Kramer, we want to thank you for introducing us and kind of bringing us up to speed on what's going on down in the Appalachian region, and want to wish you good luck in your work and in your life as a farmer.
Thank you, Tim. It's hard work, but it's good work, and I appreciate your good wishes to you as well.
We want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine Podcast. I encourage you to look online for a couple special online features. One, we have a video interview with Michael Paul Gallagher, the Irish Jesuit, on Blessed Cardinal John Henry Newman. We also have a piece by David Van Bima, formerly of Time Magazine, on Blessed Mother Teresa and how the organization UNICEF is using some of her approaches to poverty. Reminder, you can respond to our podcast at americanmagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.